Okay, we're broadcasting live. And the audio is live anyway. I'm going to hold off on the video. Because otherwise we'll have two copies of the Dhammapada. So we're going to start with teaching on the Dhammapada. Test, test. Left, are you kidding me? Come on. Come on, what's wrong? Why would that be? Plugged in properly. So many little things. Okay, so we are ready to go. Start with the Dhammapada and then I'll turn on the video, the broadcast, the broadcast. Test, test. Okay. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Tonight we continue on with verse number 109, which reads Abhivadana Silisa Nityang Vardha Pachayino Chataro Dhamma Vadanti Ayukvanno Sukhang Palang. Which means Abhivadana Siddhisa, for one who is of a manner or who has as their behavior, their character, respect or the attitude of paying reverence, who is by nature reverential. Uddha pachayino, bowing down or bowing down to those who are buddha, which could mean people who are old or people who are senior, bowing down to their seniors or to people who are worthy of their respect in some way or another. Chataro dhamma vadanti, four dhammas increase for that person. Ayu, long life. Vana, vano, health. Sukhang, happiness. Balang, strength. So this is probably the most famous, probably the most well known of the Dhammapada verses among Buddhists, among Theravada Buddhists. Why? Because it's used in I think every one of the Theravada countries as a blessing, as kind of a reminder of the blessing when people do pay respect. So when there are ceremonies and people come and pay respect to the monks and offer food to the monks give as a blessing this verse, Abhivadana Siddhisa Nityang Vardha. So you might hear it if you go to a Buddhist monastery. At the very end of their blessings, whether it be Sri Lankan or Thai or I'm not sure about Burmese, but I imagine certainly Laos, Cambodia, all these countries, it's used as a blessing. So it's not a blessing, it's not saying may you have these things, it's just reminding you or pointing out the fact that the Buddha taught that these things increase when people are reverential or respectful. So respect is considered a good thing. Respect is considered to be, as we've seen in the past few verses, this is actually the only reason this verse belongs in this chapter, which is actually the chapter on thousands. So everything in this verse should be about a thousand this, a thousand that, or a many number of things. It actually it's that it goes with the verses before, which we're talking about abhivadana. When someone pays reverence to those, is respectful to those who are worthy of respect, it's a great thing, is what they were saying. So this one is saying that four things increase. This was told in regards to a boy, when the Buddha was dwelling in an Aranyakuti, a place in a kuti in the forest, a hut in the forest, near a town called Digalangika. I have no idea where that is. In reference to a young boy who was named Digayu. Diga means long and ayu means life. Digayu. That was his name. Now, I don't think it was his name when he was born. In fact, well, the story goes there were two Brahmins and they left the home life, and I think before they were married, so these were young men who decided to live their lives as ascetics, not Buddhist ascetics, but they lived off in the forest doing austerities, torturing themselves, that kind of thing, doing the various religious practices outside of the Buddha's teaching for 48 years. And then one day, one of the Brahmins, one of the friends, these two friends, decided or realized or somehow found it somehow important through in his meditations living in the forest, he somehow decided that it was important that he continue his line, his lineage. It was a somehow became an important thing for him, although you got to cynically wonder whether it was just an excuse, because it's easy to come up with excuses to leave the religious life. And you'll always hear these when people want to disrobe. They'll have lots of reasons, this or that. One of the funniest reasons is when people say, I haven't experienced many things in the world, so I've never gotten drunk, I've never had a girlfriend, and I don't feel like I can fully appreciate the religious life until I go and do those things. A very slippery sort of argument. But it's an excuse, it's certainly not the real reason. So I wonder whether this was actually the real reason, or if whatever, you know, it was maybe the activities involved surrounding the furthering of one's line that he was maybe more interested in. Anyway, he got married and he had a boy. And when the boy was born, he immediately brought him to the other Brahmin, who was still an ascetic, because he wanted to get him to he wanted to get his blessing. And the Brahmin, they came forward to the Brahmin, and he saluted, the father saluted his old friend, at which point he said, the ascetic said, may you live long. Tikayu ko hohi. Tikayu ko hohi. May you live long, may you live a long life. And then the mother paid respect, and he said to her the same thing. May you live long. And then they brought the boy, and they introduced him to the ascetic. And the ascetic was silent. He didn't say anything. And so the friend was a little bit disgruntled at this. And so he asks him, you know, why is it that you bless us, but you won't bless our boy? And he said, well, no. Thing is, something's going to happen to your boy. So this guy, I guess he had some kind of magical, spiritual insight powers that allowed him to see some danger. And so this was a common thing that people claimed to be able to do in India. Even today, you know, astrologers claim to be able to read people's futures, that kind of thing. not just in the stars, but they'll do it in other ways. Be able to see people's auras or see their futures, that kind of thing. So he claimed this, and his Brahmin friend got quite scared, and knowing this was his friend, there was no reason for him to trick him or try and deceive him. So he said, "Is there anything you can do? What do you know what I can do to stop this?" He says some danger, and the man says, what sort of danger? He said, "He's only going to live a short time." And the man says, "How long?" He says, 7 days. Your boy is only going to live 7 days. That's his future. And the Brahmin gets scared, and he says, "Is there anything I can do?" And I don't know. Well, is there someone who does know? And of course, this looks like a job for her. He says, "Well, you know, there's that ascetic Gotama, and he does know a lot. Everyone's always praising him for his knowledge and his ability to teach people the right way to practice. So maybe you could go ask him." So indeed, he takes his son to go and see the Buddha and pays respect. The Buddha says the same thing. Nigayuko hotu hohi, may you live a long life. And same to the mother. They bring the baby forward, same thing. He doesn't say anything. And so again, he asks him the question, "What can I do? Is there something I can do?" "Yeah, there's something you can do." "Ah, what should I do?" And here's the Buddha's cure for short life. He says, "What you can do is you can set up a pavilion at your house with 8 chairs or 16 seats, 8 or 16, he gives them an option. And he says, "And invite my disciples to come and chant for 7 days. They're going to do protective chanting, means they'll chant the teachings of the Buddha and do that for 7 days. And that will resolve your problem. That will save your son." And he said, "Well, okay, I can set up a pavilion, but how do I get your monks to come?" The Buddha said, "If you set it up, we will come. If you build it, we will come." And so he does that. He sets up this pavilion, sets up these seats, and invites people to come and listen. And for 7 days, indeed, non-stop, so the monks would take shifts, they did chanting for this Brahmin, and the Brahmin fed them and gave gifts to each of the monks, I guess, you know, to kind of thank them for their... Now, I mean, it becomes a bit of a... I don't know if that's fair to say, because I don't think it even says that he gave them gifts, but it's an interesting sort of setup, because you wonder, why did the monks go through all that trouble? You know, but I suppose one thing you could say is that perhaps it was an opportunity to teach the Dhamma, because many people would come and listen, because he set up a pavilion in a public place. And so what they, and another thing, sorry, is that they set the baby up in a crib or in a seat in the middle of the monks, so with the monks surrounding him. And yeah, so at first glance you might think, well, why were the monks spending 7 days doing this? But the fact is that not only did humans come and listen, angels came and listened as well. It became a huge event. It's kind of like the show of the century or something. All the humans and angels and everybody who was anybody came to listen to this event. So that was what the Buddha prescribed. He said, you know, you have to do something big. You have to do some big good deed. And that, then this is the good deed. Have the recitation of the Dhamma. Allow for this teaching of the Dhamma to go on for 7 days and set it up, facilitate this. And so the Buddha got the monks to go and teach the Dhamma for 7 days, chanting it, reciting it for 7 days. And of course they would understand it, and it was all a teaching, right? Now, here's the thing, you see. It sounds kind of superstitious, of course. It sounds strange that they should be able to predict the future, first of all. And then it sounds kind of... I'm thinking of from a secular point of view. And then it sounds kind of odd that, you know, kind of suspicious that this... there's somehow a relationship. You know, why is it that for seven, that this is going to avert his death. You know, it's maybe it's good to listen to good things and it makes you feel better, but here we've got this 7-year-old or this day-old child or this newborn child. What good's it going to do to him? You know, do these things really provide protection? Is there some magic involved that they protect you from death, so death can't come near? And the funny thing is, which makes this a very Buddhist story, is that there is a reason behind it. The only really superstitious or non-secular or kind of thing that most skeptics would have a serious problem with is the problem of angels. Because it's actually a story about angels, this story. Story goes that there was a yakka, which is like a demon or kind of, like some kind of demigod or something, some kind of weird angel who actually is not very nice. And he did something for one of the angels. You know, there's all this politics and favoring and gifting and that kind of thing. So he was owed a favor by one of the angels. One of these angels who, I don't know, some angel. I don't know. Let me see. Vaisavana, yeah. Vaisavana was, I think he was the architect for Sakka or something, I don't know. It was some part of the angel hierarchy. And the yakka was named Avarudaka, for people who are interested in such things. But the deal went that he owed this guy a favor, and so he said, well then, I'll look the other way, and we'll pick a baby for you to eat. That's how the story goes. And so they picked this baby, and this baby was supposed to be the sacrifice. I don't know the details of it. It sounds horrific, and you know, just befuddling as to what was really going on there, what was going on behind the scenes. But somehow this was an agreement that was made. That you get this child. How he, this angel had authority over the child, I don't know. It was kind of like a look the other way thing because he owed this yakka a favor. That's the story. And so he said, you got 7 days. This is the deal. I'll turn my back for 7 days, look the other way, and you can eat the child. So they really did protect him, you see, because when they brought the monks in, all the angels crowded in. Sakka and all the angels who were anybody who was anybody came to listen. And so there was absolutely no chance that this yakka could get anywhere near them. There was such a hierarchy that he had to back up, and the closest he could get to the boy was something like 16 leagues. He had to step back 12 leagues. And that was as close as he could get to the pavilion. And so for 7 days the monks did this chanting, and on the 7th day the Buddha came. Walked in, sat down in a seat prepared for him, and spent all night teaching the Dhamma, taking his turn. And when the sun rose on the 8th day, he turned to the child and he said, may you live long. And they asked him how long he's going to live, and the Buddha said he's going to live 120 years. So they gave him the name Digayuka, or Digayu. They gave him the name Ayuvaddana, which means one whose life increases. Vadana, increasing. So that's the story. And then, as it is said, the monks were hanging out in the Dhammasala one day, talking, discussing, and they said, it's amazing, you know, that this kid who was going to live 7 days, and that was somehow his karma. There was something going on there. That was as a result of, sorry, I shouldn't say that was his karma, that was some result of some deeds that had been done in the past, so it's strange that suddenly that changed. And Buddha walked, and they thought to themselves, they said, you know, wonder what the thing is. What is it that changes this, that allows people, what is it that increases people's life? What is it that truly, what Dhamma is it? Or what sort of Dhammas allow for the increase, for one's lifespan to increase in this way? What's the mechanism? And the Buddha walked in and asked them what they were talking about, and they told him. And the Buddha said, monks, for one who is respectful constantly, who is of a nature to constantly, nityang, ever be respectful and bow down, you know, to bend down, you know. This idea of bending down in the sense of not being lording over or saying, I'm your equal and I don't have to pay respect to anyone, and so on. A person who is able to respect others, is able to look up to others and accept that other people might be able to help them or might be worthy of their respect, I think. Such a person, the Buddha said, four things increase, not just life, but four things increase. And then he taught this verse. Chattaro dhamma vadanti ayu, life, vana, health, sukhang, ayu, vano, sukhang, happiness, balang, strength. So that's the verse. Again, not directly related to our practice, more related to mind states, but a lot of these are. And as a result, are very much a part of our practice, because respect, humility, these things are all a part of our practice. Had an interesting experience today that kind of relates to this potentially. It made me wonder, you know. I was teaching meditation today to a new group of people, and one of the meditators, normally you have people say the words out loud, because I want to see that they're doing it correctly. So I say, okay, say it loudly with me. Stepping right, stepping left. And I watched them. I went to one by one to see if they're doing it correctly. And I came up to this one, and I said, and she wasn't saying it out loud. And I said, can you say it out loud for me? She said, no. I said, oh, I think I said, like, why not? And she said, I don't want to. And it made me think, you know, I mean, should you say something? Should there be? Well, it made me think that in certain cases that could be really a problem for the person. If they really don't have that faculty that is respectful, you know, when your teacher tells you to do something, it's to just say no to them. Because it's oblivious. If you say, I'm sorry, or, you know, if you're respectful, because this person has come to teach you, and, you know, I wasn't getting paid or anything, I wasn't a client. So it made me think, but I don't think that's what it was about. I'm really not sure what it was about, but, you know, people have their issues, and sometimes those issues are, you know, it's not disrespect all the time. I don't think it was sincerely disrespect, but in most cases there's a sense there, and I've seen this before, where there's just this switch that hasn't turned on, like, oh yes, right, I should respect this person because they are teaching me something new, something that I don't know. They have something over me, you see? I mean, it's not like lording over, but it's someone you should look up to, is someone who has knowledge that you don't have. That's something that you should be respectful for, because they don't have to give it to you. They're giving it to you out of kindness and so on. Anyway, there's this is a tradition, and I think in the West there's real attitude about this. And I'm not saying on this case it was, but in certain cases where people have this attitude of Not that you have to bow down or something like that, but just don't get this that if a teacher tells you to do something, you don't have to do it. You can say, I'm sorry, I don't feel comfortable with that. But there should be some sense of respect and saying an apology, you know? I think in the West we less have that, but I don't know. Having lived in Asia for so long, maybe, or being a meditator, I can't help but even my teachers at school. As I said before, one of my professors, the guy before him, leaves chalk dust all over his desk, and he comes in, and he puts his MacBook down on the table, and it gets all the chalk dust in it, and it ruined his computer at one point. So since then, I've gone and I've wiped down the table before class. I mean, and it just seems like, of course I would do that. I mean, that's something that we do because this person is teaching us. This is something, you know. We do it for our parents because, you know, our respect for them. For most of us, our parents are worthy of respect, and sometimes we don't give them the respect they're worthy of. You know. Some maybe aren't. I know there are parents who aren't really worthy of much respect, but for the most part, they are. So it is, in some sense, a part of our meditation in terms of being a mind state that is important. It provides worldly benefits, but it also provides a great... It's a necessary, sort of, it's a bar. If you're not respectful, then... Can't get very far. So another aspect of this story that's quite interesting, and I already talked about it, the somewhat secular nature of the protection verses. Most Buddhists and non-Buddhists who see this think that protection and chanting protections, because Buddhists around the world do these protective chantings, they think it's something magical, like there's some magic involved. And this is kind of very Buddhist thing to sort of explain it in a way that is totally secular. Now, you might argue this isn't totally secular. We've got a talk of angels in here, and that's totally faith-based because none of us have ever seen angels. But, you know, we could argue that that's our fault, that we just aren't in tune enough to see the angels like other people are. But we could also just appropriate this story and say it in another way. I mean, the concept stays the same, and it's this concept of the power of goodness. You think, well, goodness has power, so what does that mean? If you do good deeds, magically good things happen to you? No. Things like this happen to you. You know, like people take care of you. If you're surrounded by good people, suppose a kid is in school, and he makes friends with some stronger kids, you know. And then the bullies come around, well, he's got all these friends who he was nice to and kind to and friends with, and other people who respected him. And suppose there's a kid who helps some older kids with his home with their homework, just out of, they ask him for help, or not older kids, so the geeky kid helps the jock kid, you know, things like that. I mean, it's a simple idea that good deeds make friends. Good deeds bring lots and lots of good results, both worldly and spiritual. They affect your mind and make you more calm and peaceful. And I think that is an important... It is related to our meditation practice, because humility, true humility, not this fake sort of, oh, I'm so humble, oh, I'm such a... You know, we can get very humble, we can fake humility. Religious people are very good at faking humility. Buddhists tend to... It's potential. There's a potential to fall into a fake humility just by affecting it, you see. We're not affecting. We're not talking about affecting. Only through meditation practice, and that's the relationship here to our practices, it is meditation practice that leads to true humility. Why? Because you start to see that you're actually worthless. You see that what I thought was worthwhile, this body of mine, beautiful, strong, you know, powerful, this brain, this mind that is, you see, it's all rubbish, it's all garbage, it doesn't really work, it's broken, doesn't listen to you. and it breaks down, and the end is just all a bunch of garbage. And you lose. This is like what Sariputta said recently. We had one of his stories where he said, you know, he was accused of hitting this other guy. He said, well, for someone who has a big ego, that's certainly possible. For someone who still has attachment to self, then yeah, certainly possible. Me, I regard this self like a young man or woman who is bathed and well clothed, just like they would regard a dog carcass hanging around their neck. That's how I regard this body. That's how I regard this being. And that's where true humility comes from. You start to see that reality is not worth clinging to. Sabbe dhamma na langa binivesaya. No dhamma, all dhammas are not worth clinging. Indeed, not worth clinging to. And so the practice of meditation, seeing things arise and cease, seeing the chaos, seeing the unmanageability, unwieldiness of the body and mind, you let go. You don't suffer from the changes, from the chaos, from the uncertainty. It's not that you change it and make it certain and make it controllable and so on. It's just you stop suffering from it. You stop suffering, you stop attaching. Because you stop attaching, you become more respectful, more kind, more compassionate, more caring, less angry and vicious and mean and cruel. And as a result, people respect you and good things happen to you. There's no magic behind it. Although it sometimes seems magical, because so many little things, you see. You do some good deed for someone and it impacts in so many other ways. Other people see you, your own mind changes, the world becomes a nicer place, and so on. So many small things. And then suddenly it comes back to you and it seems like magic. Wow, suddenly this kid is living 120 years. Behind the scenes, who knows what's going on? Who knows what beings there are? You know, or even not talking about beings. Like angels, just in terms of humans, so many different things. In terms of your own mind and how the choices you make. People who are mean and nasty tend to make rash choices, and their life changes as a result. So, respect, reverence, these are humility. These are all qualities that we could all learn to emulate. So this is an important Dhamma. Something for us to consider. Respect is important, the Buddha said. It's so important that it can change your life. It can give you long life, give you health, give you happiness, give you strength. These are the four blessings of the Triple Gem. So by listening respectfully on this occasion, if you were listening respectfully, if you were sitting joking and laughing and making fun of me this whole time, well then, you don't get this, but if those of you who are sitting paying respect or sitting listening respectfully to the Dhamma on this occasion, I say, Jattaro Dhamma Vadanti Ayu Onno Sukham Balam. Thank you for tuning in. Keep practicing. Have a good night. So that was the Dhammapada. Now we are going to live broadcast on YouTube. It's a bit weird, you know, because is anyone still going to be here to hear our broadcast? Hello, good evening, everyone. Now we are broadcasting. This is Daily Dhamma. Well, that's not really the point, see, because live broadcast gets, say, 30, 40 people, which is good. But the actual video, this video, is now going to go out to many people. So what I've done tonight is I've just given a teaching on the Dhammapada before broadcasting live. And so that will go up as its own separate video tonight, and you'll see it probably tomorrow. This video is going to be... Sorry. Just answering questions. And maybe talking about a verse or a quote. I have quotes. So with me tonight is Robin. Hello, Robin.
Hello, Bhante.
And all the people at meditation.sirimangalo.org. Is there anybody there?
We have questions.
Oh, good. Okay, shoot.
Okay, this is a long question. Mm-hmm. Dear Bhante, when one starts practicing Satipatthana Vipassana without any prior training in any kind of meditation, is it necessary to have distraction-free surroundings? I understand that the practice has to do with being mindful of absolutely any kind of experience that arises out of the six sense doors, no matter how chaotic the environment, always noting the most distinct and strong experience. So basically, there is no such thing as necessity for distraction-free surroundings. But at the beginning, it feels like the practice cannot go anywhere when there are so many things happening every second. I understand that the practice is not about concentration. Is one guaranteed to eventually progress on the path by following the teaching, even if the practicing environment is chaotic from the beginning, just by being able to have mindful moments here and there? Even though momentary concentration is the only kind of concentration that has something to do with the practice, does one anyway need stillness and quietness at the beginning?
I think you might be confusing two things, you see, because it's not the environment, but if you're talking about, so you mentioned something about just having mindful moments here and there. Well, okay, see, if you meant by that you don't have an environment that you can actually physically sit down and meditate in, like if you do that, people are going to hit you or scold you or think you're crazy, throw garbage at you or something, then yeah, that's problematic. If you're talking just about the distraction of your mind, well, there are limits, I think. And the whole reason for doing formal meditation in the first place is to limit our distractions. So yes, there is something to what you're saying, that it shouldn't be just full contact right away. That being said, there are different levels of distraction. If people are talking around you, that can be really difficult. But I've had meditators who were able to sit through it. I mean, I've done it. I remember once doing a course in Thailand, and there were monks sitting right outside my kuti, at a table right outside my hut, talking all day. They sat there talking right in front of my hut, so I heard walking and sitting. I couldn't really understand. Well, it was difficult, but eventually, really the key is that eventually your mind is able to put it aside. And that's really what we're looking for. I mean, you say your practice isn't able to go anywhere. Well, I'd wonder where you're trying to go. What does it mean going anywhere? Because the whole desire to go somewhere is really a problem. You're not trying to go somewhere, you're trying to understand what's going on in your mind. So at that moment, what's going on in your mind? Your mind is being distracted by things. So you're learning about that. Meditation is for the purpose of learning about that, understanding it. What's going on? It's about learning about your habits, how you react to things. It's about learning to react differently, you know, learning why your reactions have problems, learning about the things that you're reacting to and realizing that they're not worth reacting to. So it's actually a very important learning practice. Now, if it's overwhelming, then you have to decide for yourself how much of a retreat you need. But that's certainly not inherently counterproductive. It just means you're weak. Most of us are fairly weak. So if you want to, that's what you're suggesting here, then yes, you can admit your weakness and you can back off. But you have to admit your weakness and say, okay, this isn't a problem with the situation, this is a problem with me. And then you have to assess as to whether you're hiding from your challenges or whether you are retreating temporarily. Because eventually you're going to have to deal with it. I remember once I was in Israel, and I went and did meditation on the beach in Tel Aviv, and these flies came. And my whole face was covered in flies. It was bizarre. Well, no, not covered, but there were maybe 5 or 10 flies. And at first I tried, but if you've ever had a fly on your face, Imagine 5 or 10. There, it's not like having an ant or something. Houseflies, because they have tongues on their feet or something. They're really. So I just shook them off and had to walk away. And I went and told the teacher, this Israeli man who's now a monk, and he's a very good teacher, and he said, Noah, if you don't deal with it now, you'll have to deal with it eventually. I can't get his accent, but he had this thick, thick Middle Eastern accent. And he said, whatever experience you don't deal with now, you'll have to deal with eventually. I'm still a bit skeptical because, man, that was pretty tough. No, he's right. But I don't know that I totally agree that you have to eventually deal with it. It's not really that. It's that it's just a sign that you're weak. And I think what he was meaning and what he was saying is not that eventually I'd have to deal with flies on my face. I mean, that's not really the point. But there's some reason why I couldn't deal with the flies on my face. And eventually I'm going to have to deal with that reason. There's no way out. There's no way around our aversions, there's no way around our problems. Eventually you have to deal with them. So that's sort of an answer, yeah. I don't think anyone needs stillness or quiet, but I already explained it, you retreat sometimes. Just be careful, because I know that I had one meditator once, I was watching one meditator once, I think I've mentioned this. He started sitting on the floor, and then we said he could use a cushion, so he put a little cushion underneath, and then I watched him from day to day, like over a couple of days, his seat got higher and higher and higher until he was might as well be sitting on a chair. And I said, well, you know, we're really trying to go the other way. It's normal for you to get lower as you go on, you know, get more tolerance of pain and so on. So that's important, just to be careful that you're not going in the wrong direction.
Hello, Bhante. There are times when I become disconcerted by the breath that I draw, whether it be too little or too much, and feel anxious and forced to control it instead of observing it objectively as it arises naturally. I also have a diagnosed anxiety disorder and was wondering, is the anxiety acting as a hindrance by arising alongside this disruption? Or is my anxiety only another object that could use more attention as it arises? And therefore, is the disruption I mentioned only the product of a working, yet challenging practice? I'm sorry if this is a little confusing.
Anxiety is acting as a hindrance, that's certain, but it's only a hindrance in a sense of hindering your happiness, your peace of mind. In Vipassana, we don't really think of them as hindrances. We call them hindrances, but only because that's what they're called elsewhere. In the practice, hindrances are considered important meditation objects. So you do take them as a meditation object just like anything else. And I've talked about anxiety before. Not only anxiety, you also have to focus on the as with everything, you have to focus on what surrounds the anxiety, the physical aspects. So the tension that's going to arise in your breath probably, the headache sometimes, tension in the shoulders, the heart beating fast, that kind of thing. Many different things. Fear is involved. So you're seeing how your mind works, and it works not very well. That's normal. There's nothing that should be disconcerting about that. Shouldn't be something that disheartening. There's nothing disheartening about that. What you're trying to do is understand and learn to let go of what you can let go of, and well, through understanding, to not exactly change, but the understanding itself will change many things about your mind. It will help change the anxiety. As you watch the anxiety, you're basically teaching yourself the problem with anxiety. And your mind starts to starts to change how it reacts to things, being less anxious, less inclined to react with anxiety or get worried about things. Because you see that anxiety is useless, is harmful. You really see it. Like normally we think, oh, I know it's useful, useless, I want to get rid of it. It's not the same. We still have this aspect of our mind that thinks that it's good. So you change that by learning that it's not good.
And then just a continuation of the earlier question about things being chaotic. I kind of meant that the environment is chaotic from the beginning. Can the meditator ever really have mindful moments?
Absolutely. You have to understand what mindfulness is. Even if the environment is chaotic, well, what does that mean? There is sound? If there's sound, then you say hearing, hearing, and then you're mindful. What does it mean to say the environment is chaotic? If someone's hitting you, well, then you say pain, pain. I don't know. Usually that would mean sound, right? The environment is chaotic just means there's sound arising at the ear. Well, sound is just sound. You say hearing, hearing.
So even if your entire meditation was noting hearing, that would be okay.
Sound arises and ceases. Did I tell you the story of what was watching someone and they were saying, they were teaching meditation and they said, when you see, you say seeing, seeing. When you hear, say hearing. And as they said that, they were clearly following their own advice. And as they said, you say hearing, hearing. And they literally did this. And they stayed like that for a minute or two. And the meditator was was confused. And I was sitting watching this happen in front of me. Incredible. It means you can become enlightened through sound if your mind is clear enough.
Hey Bhante, my area is very dominated by fundamentalist Christians who are very judgmental of anyone who doesn't follow their particular religion. What would be the Buddhist way to approach this? I'm not out spreading Buddhism on street corners or making myself known, but I do not want to draw unwanted attention to myself or be an object of discrimination.
I don't know, I don't, nothing hits me right away. I mean, be mindful. There's a story of a monk who came to the Buddha. I think he was an arahant, so there's that. But he came to the Buddha, and he said to the Buddha he was going back to his homeland, or he was going to stay in a certain land. And the Buddha said, oh, well, those people are really harsh. They're not very friendly. He said, what if they say nasty things to you? What will you do? He said, Venerable Sir, if they say nasty things to me, I'll just think to myself, oh, these people are so civilized that they don't hit me. And the Buddha said, well, what if they hit you? And he said, well, then I'll just think these people are so civilized that they don't break my bones or cause real harm. And the Buddha said, well, what if they cause real harm? And then he said, well, if they do, I'll just think, well, these people are civilized, so civilized, that they don't kill me. And the Buddha said, what if they kill you? And he said, if they kill me, Venerable Sir, then I'll just think to myself, many of the beings who have sought for an assassin. That's rather kind of weird, and I think you have to be an arahant to really understand. Well, not even arahant. You have to understand the idea of an arahant to get this. He said, many are the enlightened beings. Many beings, many followers of the Buddha have wished for an assassin, someone to end them, to end their life. I don't know if wished is exactly the right word, but what he's trying to say is that there's no There's no problem with death. You know, death isn't a problem because life is. There's no meaning anymore for a person who is enlightened. They are free from attachment. And meaning he had no fear of death. It wasn't a problem for him. The Buddha said, "Okay, in that case, you're ready to go and live with these people." And he did, and he actually established the Sangha there. That's what the sutta ends by saying. He went and lived there, and he established a Buddhist Sangha, people meditating to be free from suffering in a place that was full of barbarians. So I think some of these places are kind of barbaric, where people are. You're probably not surrounded by barbarians, but to some extent, you know, religious fundamentalists can be pretty barbaric. And very judgmental. So you just laugh it off. You have to learn to be mindful and not let it be like water off of a lotus leaf, the Buddha said. Just like a lotus doesn't get wet, the water, the raindrops, they just fall off. Like, what do we say in English? Water off a duck's back? Is that what we say? We say something like that?
Yes.
Best way to deal with Christians, I've talked about this before, religious people, is to ask them about their religion. Learn about it. It takes energy, though. I think after a while you'd probably get tired of that. But if they approach you, it is often the best way out is to just ask them. Or else just be silent, I suppose, you know? If you really just don't want to talk, then just don't say anything. But if you talk to them, if you ask them questions, they end up tying their own noose, hanging themselves. Meaning they end up damning themselves, you know, like contradicting themselves. Because these religions are not very solid, not very well founded on reality. It's by being unchallenged and unquestioned. Not challenged, but not being forced to back up their claims and that kind of thing. That they continue, that they're able to stay strong. So there's that.
And to follow up on the question about concentration in a chaotic environment, but if there is absolutely no concentration, can someone without any prior experience in meditation just decide to be mindful now in a chaotic situation and have benefit?
Don't worry about concentration. Concentration arises through mindfulness. Yeah, you start being mindful in one moment. A person who's new to it is just not very good at creating mindfulness. Yeah, no, maybe you're right. It is a point that they're probably just going to get distracted and frustrated and so on. But I think that's more of a view than anything, you know? If you have the view that, oh, this is, you know, I can't meditate, this is too chaotic, then that's the problem. So if you know, like I've explained, and as Simon, I think, added in something useful there, if you can see it just as experience, then it's not very difficult to be mindful, and it's in fact quite rewarding. But again, it is more challenging. It's much easier to have a quiet place to meditate with one thing to be mindful of. Still very challenging.
Say you had a choice, Bhante. Say the house is noisy but the backyard is quiet. Is there anything inherently wrong with just seeking out the quiet spot?
Well, it is indulging a preference, right? Potentially. There are other reasons, I suppose. You could be endorsing quiet in the sense that, you know, people, the reasons why it's loud could be that people are engaging in entertainment or talking, yakking, chatting, that kind of thing. But if your preference, if you're not able to deal with the noise, you know, if it's just a matter of, like, maybe music, or I don't know. I mean, there are certain noises that are difficult. Like music is probably difficult, but definitely talking is difficult. Difficult, why? Because your mind gets naturally involved in that. So it's really distracting. It's really difficult to stay undistracted, because our minds are receptive of that. But just loud noises, like let's say a big one where I were in Stony Creek, was the car noises. And that is just noise, and it's interesting because we get irritated by it and distracted, and it interrupts our concentration. But that's kind of a good thing. It lets you see how you react to things. I think there's definitely a potential problem. Like if in that case you went and sought out a quieter spot, you're only going to hurt yourself in the end, because you're going to be more averse to noise. Like when I had this alarm clock ticking, tick, 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 and I had to, I got more and more fed up until finally I just had to suppress the sound. And then when I got moved to another place that had two clocks on the wall and this ticking, it made me insane. And then I realized, you know, this isn't the way, I have to go another way. And so I learned just to be mindful. Like it was actually affecting my walking, lifting here, lifting, moving, play, sync, because I couldn't get out of sync with the tick. Until finally I just said, okay, if I'm gonna be in sync, I'm gonna be in sync, and I have to learn to let go of this. And I really did, it was really quite rewarding.
I think with that, we're all caught up with questions.
Okay. Well then. Good night, everyone. Thank you, Robin, for your help. Thanks, everyone, for your questions and for watching and getting involved. I'll have a Dhammapada up soon.
Thank you, Bhante.
Good night.
Good night.